Okay, the lights came on, but the battery went off. What can I say? Some of you might remember a few years ago, we had a guest minister here at First Unity who did the entire Sunday service barefoot. Now, I remember clearly, how many remember that? I remember clearly looking up and realizing she didn't have any shoes on, and I thought, did she forget to pack her shoes? Do her feet hurt? Is she trying to show off her pedicure? What's going on here? I didn't get it. And somebody said to me after the service, I'll never forget, that in the beginning, they thought that it seemed a little irreverent for her to be doing that. And yet, the exact opposite was her intent. Her purpose was to show us that we were standing on holy ground. And it's absolutely true. Wherever we are standing on holy ground. God is always with us, and there is never any place we can be that God is not. However, knowing that we always stand on holy ground, there are still some places that really seem to hold high spiritual energy for us. Probably for a lot of us in this room, one of those places is Unity Village, right? You've been there, it does. You can just feel the energy when you enter the grounds. For many people in the world, one of those places that holds that high spiritual energy is Jerusalem. And one of the holiest cities, or holiest sites, I should say, in Jerusalem is what's called the Old City. There it is. It's just a maze of narrow alleyways and historic architecture. The picture you're looking at now I took in the Muslim quarter. And all four quarters are surrounded by a fortress-like stone wall. Now, the Old City holds some of the most sacred sites in the world, including the Western Wall. And there it is. Thank you, honey. The Western Wall is commonly called the Wailing Wall, and it's the last remnant of the temple from Jesus' day. Okay, it's not working, all right. And people come here from all over the world to pray and insert prayer requests in the wall. Bob and I happen to be there on a Saturday, and you can see if the books and the tables, people had actually had service, and then they were requesting prayers. So now, knowing that this is the only remaining part of the temple where Jesus spoke and where Jesus worshiped, let's just kind of do a brief history of Jesus' affiliation with that temple. Luke tells us in chapter 2, verses 22 to 24, that shortly after Jesus' birth, when it was time for Mary's purification, she and Joseph brought the babe to be presented to the Lord at the temple of Jerusalem as required by Mosaic law. Now, at the temple, they offered a sacrifice, also required by Mosaic law, of a pair of turtle doves or two pigeons. Now, I doubt that Jesus really remembered that trip since he made that one as a baby, and perhaps it's just as well because that was also the time of his circumcision, so maybe it was okay that he didn't remember it. But in the years that followed, it's possible that Jesus accompanied his parents on annual pilgrimages to the temple as commanded in Deuteronomy. We just really don't know that for sure. There's no record of it. But we do all know the story of Jesus at 12 going to the temple with his parents for Passover. Remember, his parents left for home, and unbeknownst to them, Jesus remained back at the temple just talking and posing questions and answering questions of all the rabbis, and he was only 12 years old. Of course, when his parents realized he was missing, they were frantic, and they made their way all the way back to the temple. His mother immediately did what all mothers would do in a case like that. She scolded him for worrying them so much, and he replied to her, "Did you not know that I would be in my father's house?" Now, I taught 12-year-olds for years, and I can get the tone. It was like, "Mom and Dad, don't you get it?" That was his tone there. And this is, interestingly, the earliest record of where Jesus speaks of God as Abba, or in the Hebrew, Avi, my father, which is translated as Papa, a term of loving endearment. And so, I know you can't see that too well, but the rectangular areas where the temple would have been. The temple where Jesus worshiped was not the original temple, and that's important for us to remember. The first temple was actually constructed centuries before his birth by Solomon. the son of King David. Now, Solomon's magnificent temple, built of great stones and cedar beams and boards overlaid with gold, took 7 years to complete. And when it was finished, Solomon inaugurated it with, there it is, he inaugurated it with prayers and sacrifice. During the dedication of the temple, as highlighted in both Kings and 2 Chronicles, Solomon offered, are you ready for this? 200,000 oxen and 120 sheep, and the celebratory feast lasted for 14 days. Those people knew how to party, did they not? I mean, unbelievable. And Solomon's temple lasted 400 years until it was destroyed by the Babylonians. And the Jews were then forced into exile. Now, after the fall of Babylon, the Persian emperor, Cyrus the Great, allowed the Jews to return to Israel and rebuild the temple. And it wasn't until 20 BCE that the actual temple where Jesus worshiped was rebuilt. And this is what it looked like. And it was built by Herod. Now, what Herod did was take the temple that had been rebuilt after the exile and just really expanded it into a magnificent scale. Herod, of course, the Roman-appointed king of Judea, wanted to be remembered as the builder of the greatest temple on earth. And he owed the Jews a lot for all of his executions, but we won't get into that today. He kept the original floor plan of Solomon's temple, but he doubled the size of it and added all these surrounding courtyards. Actually, he had a huge platform built on the top of the mount. The temple took over 10,000 skilled workers and 80 years to complete. Can you imagine that? One of the most beautiful creations of the ancient world, it attracted pilgrims from near and far, both Jews and Gentiles. And I don't have it on the slide, but for those of you who are still awake and interested in the rest of the history of it, it was destroyed in 70 AD under the Roman Emperor Nero. So the story we're going to look at today actually occurs in the courtyard surrounding the temple. And it's the story of Jesus driving the money changers out of the temple. And it's told in all four Gospels. The three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, place the story at the close of Jesus' ministry, really shortly before the crucifixion. Today we're going to read from Mark, our earliest Gospel writer. And here's what Mark says about the event. Then they went to Jerusalem, they being Jesus and his disciples, and part of the crowd. And Jesus entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone even to carry anything through the temple. He was teaching and saying, "Is it not written?" And this comes from Isaiah. From the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, is it not written, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers." And when the chief priests and the scribes heard it, they kept looking for a way to kill him, for they were afraid of him, because the whole crowd was spellbound by his teaching. And when evening came, Jesus and his disciples went out of the city. So, according to Mark now, Jesus is in Jerusalem for the Feast of the Passover, Passover commemorating Israel's deliverance from bondage in Egypt, and he walks up the old steps to the temple complex, the very uneven temple steps. Now, we have to know that the word temple, I know the Bible says temple and all the versions say that, but it really meant the temple courtyards, because only the priests were allowed into the true temple, into the true sanctuary. So if it were First Unity, they'd all be outside, you know, maybe in the vestibule and all around the church. Jesus enters the court of the Gentiles, maybe you can see it on the screen, and finds it crowded with thousands of Jewish pilgrims from all over the Roman world come to celebrate Passover. Now, adding to the crowd, and just picture this for a minute, adding to the crowd are Jerusalem merchants who have set up merchandise, selling wine, oxen, sheep, and doves to the multitudes for use in ritual sacrifice. And imagine just for a moment the sights and sounds Jesus would have encountered. The loud haggling of the money changers interacting with all their customers, the bleating of the sheep, the cooing of the doves, and the bawling of the oxen, all adding to the uproar. Can you just imagine that? No wonder Jesus sprang into action. Now, in unity, we certainly believe that Jesus was both fully human and fully divine. And this story is one of those places where Jesus seems really human, doesn't he? As he engages what looks like a fit of anger, or at the very least, righteous indignation. He heads straight for the money changers, turns over the tables. You can imagine coins going everywhere. What a scene that would have been, right? But our first question about this, you know, that's the beginning to metaphysically interpret any passage is to start with questions. So our first question to this might be, and many Bible scholars have asked the same question, are still asking it, what was Jesus' motive here? What was he trying to prove? Why did he do this? What did he hope to accomplish or demonstrate to the people of the time, and indeed to us? Well, to understand why the money changers were in the temple in the first place, we need to remember that Judea was under Roman rule, and the currency of the day was a Roman coin, was Roman coins. Now, Roman coins had the image of the emperor on them. In Jesus' day, it would have been Caesar. And therefore, they were not accepted at the temple. Jewish law is very clear: no graven images. Therefore, those who made the pilgrimage to the temple in Jerusalem had to exchange Roman coins for Jewish shekels. Jewish shekel is still the currency in Israel today. Each adult male in that time was required to pay a yearly service to the temple, you might call it a temple tax, of half a shekel. And shekels were also needed to purchase all the animals for ritual sacrifice. Now, before we go further into the story, it is important for us to try to gain a little bit of an understanding about the system of sacrifice in the early Hebrew days. To us, in the modern time, it seems pretty barbaric and you know, just really unusual. But the sacrificial system dated back to antiquity and probably began in Mesopotamia. And there are all sorts of Old Testament passages supporting the practice. Author William Gilders, in an article called Sacrifice in Ancient Israel, explains a little bit about what the sacrifices meant. First of all, they were gifts to God. The Hebrew people felt like that it was their opportunity to give back to God all the gifts that God had given to them. That was one of the purposes of them. Secondly, it was to ask for or give thanks for a blessing, perhaps the birth of a baby, perhaps a good harvest, perhaps a healing. And the third one is the one we're probably most familiar with. It was sometimes used to seek penance or purification. It was used to ask forgiveness against some perceived sin that violated the laws of God. And trust me, they had a lot of laws in the Hebrew Bible, lots of laws. The animals to be sacrificed varied. Depending upon the reason and social status of the person, the economic status of the person, it could be anything from a small dove to a bull to a whole herd. Just imagine what kind of sin might be involved that required a whole hood. I don't want to think about that, but anyway. The temple in Jerusalem was the only place where these sacrifices could be made. They were not made at the local synagogues. So therefore, it was very difficult for the multitudes of pilgrims to bring all those animals for sacrifice from all the distant parts of Judea. It was more convenient for them to purchase them right at the temple. So the practice began as a convenience to people. And in the temple courtyard, changing money and selling animals became lucrative businesses. Now, when Bob and I were in Jerusalem and standing at the site where this occurred, our tour guide, who was very knowledgeable, insisted that Jesus' motives in driving out the money changers was because the practice was especially oppressive to the poor. And that's kind of a common theory. And in fact, some sources do report that some of the most corrupt of the money changers, and they were certainly not all corrupt, but some of the most corrupt charged as much as an 18% exchange rate. That would be exorbitant today, even. So perhaps some of Jesus' indignation was in seeing the faithful people from the hillsides of Galilee, his people, taken advantage of as they came to the temple. However, the Interpreter's Bible calls this event one of the most singularly important events in the ministry of Jesus. If that's so, there has to be a deeper reason for his actions. Jesus was never all that concerned about money. He looked to God as his source. And remember when he turned over the tables of the money changers, he also turned over the tables of the dove sellers. Many believe that Jesus was opposing more here than the chaos in the courtyard and unfair labor practices, that Jesus was intending to overturn more than those physical tables. His fervent protest is to tell the crowd that it's time to turn the tables regarding anything that is detracting them from the worship of God, and especially the ritual of sacrifice. Bible scholar Ed Townley really agrees with this, and he says, it's not the activities themselves that I see Jesus opposing, but the underlying religious system that maintained a false understanding of our relationship with the divine or to the divine. In other words, Jesus is opposing this whole idea of blood sacrifice because he understands it's based on an erroneous idea of the nature of God. The God of Jesus' understanding does not require sacrifice or subservience, but rather love and spiritual communion. Now, interestingly, Jesus is not the first to raise this issue about whether blood sacrifice was an appropriate way to worship God. Sprinkled throughout the Old Testament, others have raised the issue before him. One clear example is in Jeremiah 7, where God says, "For in the day that I brought your ancestors out of the land of Egypt, I did not speak to them or command them concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices." That's pretty clear. "But the command I gave them," God says, "is obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people." So in the Hebrew Bible, sacrifice usually involves some type of transformation. And when you think about it, one of the most common ways to transform something physically is to destroy it. It's what we do with leaves in the fall, isn't it? We burn them, the leaves are gone. You can't really see where they've gone, but they're gone. And so burning the animal really took the animal out of the physical realm and transferred it to an unseen, transcendent one. And biblical texts tell us, and I think this is so interesting, that God received the smoke of the burning sacrifice. And in fact, in Leviticus, it says, the odor was pleasing to God. So what do we have here? We have clearly the Hebrew people trying to reach God, trying to connect with God, whom they thought was in heaven. And where did they think heaven was? Right? Straight up, and that's how the smoke could reach God. Now, we all know Jesus' teachings about the kingdom of heaven. We reach and commune God not by sending smoke signals skyward, but by turning within to the Christ of our being. And Jesus clearly states, "My house shall be a house of prayer for all nations." The temple had its God-appointed purpose to be a house of prayer, not a house of commerce or sacrifice. And we've already said the synagogues in Capernaum that Jesus knew so well, they did not engage in blood sacrifice or any kind of sacrifice. And Jesus expected no less from the temple in Jerusalem. And while we don't know, wouldn't you like to know what it was that Jesus said to the people that day that kept them so spellbound? It's not recorded. We don't know exactly what it is, but we do know that Jesus realized that his days of teaching on this earth were numbered, and it must have been something extremely important that he shared with them. There is a sequel of sorts to this story that might give us a little clue about what Jesus might have talked about, and it is in Mark 12:28. Jesus is once again teaching in the temple when a scribe asked him, which commandment is the greatest? Jesus answered, the first is, hear, O Israel, Lord of God, the Lord is one. The Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, commandment number one, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second one is, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. And then the scribe responds to him, you are right, teacher. And the scribe repeats every word that Jesus said very prayerfully and just with great contemplation. And then the scribe says something that really pertains to today's story. He says, these commandments, this is much more important than all of the burnt offerings and sacrifices. And Jesus looks at him and says to him, you have answered so wisely. You are not far from the kingdom of heaven. And after that, nobody dared to ask Jesus any more questions. Hopefully that won't happen Thursday night with Randy, but at any rate, they were so overwhelmed, okay? So the two commandments, the two new commandments, Jesus, you know, reduces all of the hundreds and hundreds commandments in the Hebrew Bible down to these two, and they're both about love, aren't they? Loving God, loving ourselves, and loving others. And maybe that's one of the most important messages of this story for us today. I don't see any money changers out in our vestibule. I didn't see any of you dragging in lambs or doves or any other animal for sacrifice today. And knowing this crowd, if you had been dragging them in, you probably would have held them in your laps and loved them. But at any rate, we don't, you know, it's a practice that's no longer done, you know, and so it's gone. So what is it that we can learn from this story? Because there has to be a special message just for each one of us. Because Charles Fillmore taught that the stories and the characters in the Bible show us the spiritual unfoldment of our own souls. And very interestingly, metaphysically, the Israelites represent thoughts in consciousness. They typify that in us, which is endeavoring to follow divine law, but sometimes get sidetracked. Does that ever happen to you? Do you ever get sidetracked? In our human skins, we do. We have to give the Israelites a little break here, a big break, and realize at least they were worshiping only one God in a time where most of the other people in the universe were worshiping many, many gods, were polytheistic. And yet, even though they realized they were one God, they, like us, sometimes got diverted because of their lack of understanding about the nature of that one God, what that one God was like. And Jesus Christ came to this earth to revolutionize the prevailing concepts of God and God's relationship to humankind, to us. Now, the Hebrew Bible of the day, or the Hebrew people of the day, I should say, followed what's in the Bible, commonly known as the Mosaic Covenant. Very simply put, obey God and you will be blessed. Disobey God and watch out, you will be cursed. That was the prevailing concept of God of the day. But what did Jesus teach? Jesus taught us God is love. There is nothing we have ever done or failed to do that can keep God from loving us. One with the Most High, we are never called to make physical sacrifices or to beg and bargain with God. With every breath, every thought, we are called to remember who we are and the truth that the kingdom of God lies within. And finally, Charles Fillmore tells us that the feast of the Passover, that Jesus went to Jerusalem to observe, represents an escape from bondage. And so as Jesus overturns the tables in the temple area, I believe he's inviting each one of us to cleanse our own minds from anything that's holding us in bondage, from any old beliefs or embedded theology that might be keeping us from fully and freely living from the Christ of our being. Jesus is showing us not only that we need to turn over the tables in our own consciousness, but that we need to sacrifice and destroy anything that is keeping us from fulfilling our spiritual transformation. And that might be our own error thinking. It probably is our own error thinking. Any shred of just embedded theology about a vengeful, arbitrary God, any thoughts that we were anything less than one with God, than the perfect children of God, any thoughts that we are unworthy, anything less than the realization that we are heirs to the kingdom of God. So when we do cleanse those temples of our consciousness, we realize that God is love, pure and unconditional, and we are always, always one with that pure loving energy. And our gift to God is not to send smoke signals to the sky. Our gift to God is to be who we are and what we are created to be, the light of the world, here to express all the qualities of the divine on this earth. No matter where we are, it is true that we are truly standing on holy ground, and so it is. So let's just take a moment now to affirm what we absolutely know to be true of our God, that there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life, God, the good, omnipotent. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life, God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.